One time I saw Arcade Fire in, what's his name? The front man had the flu and he could barely perform. And then he was like, oh, don't worry about it. I'll just come. We'll turn everything off. I'll come down and we'll jam with you in the audience.
Oh.
And it was amazing until I realized he has the flu.
Yeah, he's got everybody sick.
He's spitting on everybody. Yeah. And then sure enough, I got sick the next week.
Epic fail.
Ben, when right. did it again?
My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Griffin McElroy, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Chris Plant, and I know the best game of this month.
My name is Russ Fetzi, and I know the best.
Welcome wow. to the Besties, where we discuss the latest and greatest in pop culture trends, hashtags, fashion, celebrity spats, and celebrity hookups, and video games, and hot new pizza flavored ice creams. But today, this month, it's all about video games. If you turn them on, you start to play one, you might think we're the bleeps and bloops, but they've come a long way since Pac-Man.
What if we had just done a Dad Rock concert? The entire podcast, we shifted our format exclusively Dad Rock from here on out.
I would not complain. I would complain about that. It would make it very difficult to edit. There would be lots of continuity errors. Uh-huh, one of these months, we are going to bring a Pac-Man game. You all realize that, right? Like, eventually, they're going to make a Pac-Man game that's going to be pretty good. And then
That Switch one
came out,
didn't
it? Yeah,
we had
a shot at this. Pac-Man versus,
shit, you're right.
I missed it.
This was the most buck-wild month in one of the most buck-wild years of video games since I've been alive. Can we just start talking about honorable mentions? Because I think we're going to have a lot of them.
They're all hitting. Video games are hitting so hard.
They are hitting extremely hard. I wanted to talk about SteamWorld Dig 2 on the Switch, and it's on other stuff too, right?
It's on PS4 Vita, actually. You can get...
Is it already?
Yeah.
I thought it was... Oh, okay, well.
I played it on Switch because I just really, really like playing games on Switch, and I loved SteamWorld Heist. I didn't get as deep into it as I did the original SteamWorld Dig. Which was this like new original IP game from Image and Form, I think is the name of the developer, that just like came out of nowhere and was really fucking good. It's just
Image
all
and
about,
Heap, I think.
What is it?
It's Image and Heap, I believe.
What?
I'm pretty sure you're wrong. And it's just a game about digging down and finding treasure and then spending that treasure to get upgrades to help you dig down better and like finding little puzzle chambers. And SteamWorld Dig 2 does that, but it's like 10 times bigger than the original, and it's just like this huge world that's like really, really fun to explore, and they added a bunch of new traversal mechanics that makes like getting around the world like really, really fun. I got really sick last week, like just completely like stomach death, and I just laid in bed for like 2 days and just played through all of it and not a good time. But the game
was good at time.
The game was very, very good.
It captures some, even with like a two-dimensional, like in what would feel like a fairly limiting perspective, like it captures some of the best things about games like Minecraft, I think is probably the best example of like that sense of your bag fills up and you can get pretty deep and you'll have a full bag of gems that you trade in for like a ton of cash, but you don't know how to get back up and you don't know the quickest way and you're risking death and losing some of your stuff, and it makes for like really thrilling moments where you're like, okay, I just have to keep digging, I have to find a way to get these to the surface, and also I'm out of light and I'm so close to death, but I just have to keep pushing because I have to rescue these gems. Another cool thing is like skill challenge, like there are surprising little moments of really challenging bits that are like perfectly sort of laid out there to make them very tempting. There was one I ran into recently called The Floor is Lava, where you had to navigate this entire area basically never touching the ground or the walls or the ceiling, and you just are using your hook shot type thing to grapple from place to place, and it's really, really hard. But you get a really, you get a cool reward if you beat it, I bet.
And there's a ton. Oh, you didn't. Oh, it's a shame you didn't do it. And there's a ton of really smart progression hooks in there too. Like in addition to the stuff you can buy, you can unlock skills that modify like a lot of different things about your character and how you explore the world. And there are collectibles you can find that unlock more skills. And there's a ton of stuff. I think it's a great game. And like, I love that this developer has made this thing that is such a success. Also, it neatly ties the SteamWorld Dig game into SteamWorld Heist at a certain point, which is really fucking cool. It's neat. I think it's great. They've created this world that is like, it's all the games released in this world so far have been really solid.
Something I'm fairly early on, Griffin, but something I'm struggling with that I'm curious if they remedy. I find killing enemies with the pickaxe doesn't feel very good. Do you get more options for that like later on?
Yeah, I mean, you get like pressure bombs that you can shoot out. Once you get the hook shot, once you use the hook shot, you can use that to do combat. It'll kill some enemies and it'll knock back some enemies, which you can use to just like knock them into pools of lava.
You also get like a faster melee attack that you can unlock.
There's a lot of different stuff.
But you're right. Like, I didn't really find that I was using the pickaxe for combat very much.
For a digging game, like where there's lots of, not to say that's a subgenre. But for a game where there is like this huge expanse to dig, it all feels very considered, which is even when you're deep in, you still feel like someone thought about you being there and wanted to make it a fun experience.
It is designed for pace. It is designed. It knows how many cycles of, oh, my inventory's full, I got to go back to the top. You will do before it wants you to get to a fast travel point or to a challenge room or to like a story mission or something. It's a brilliant game. We could go on and on, but September was buck wild, so let's keep pounding.
Come a long way since Dig Dug, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, not really, because this is a very Dig Dug like game.
Can you inflate enemies and make their guts pop?
No, Jesus, you fucking
That's
animal.
What you do with
What's
Dig
wrong
Crazy.
With you? I've also been playing Danganronpa V3, the newest Danganronpa game, and I'm enjoying that a lot. I've always really liked that series, and this one is really good. It takes some time to get into it, and I think this is the biggest problem with these games. It's a visual novel about 16 high schoolers. Each one represents like the most skilled person in various crafts, and they're called ultimate. So there's the ultimate detective and the ultimate inventor, they are placed in a high school where the only way to escape is to murder somebody and get away with the murder. There's always a murder, and then you go around investigating it, and then there's a class trial where everybody has to work together to figure out who the killer was, because if you get it wrong, then everybody dies. It's a really neat concept for a story and for a game. It just takes like a little. It takes a long time to like.
How long does it take to like usually play through one of these games?
I mean, a while. They're pretty beefy. I mean, visual novels in general can be pretty expansive experiences. I'm probably I would estimate like 12 hours into the story, I think I'm on the next to last sort of act of the game.
That's not so bad. See, when you say like a long time, I picture Persona where it's like, for 12 to 20 hours.
No, it's not nearly that bad.
I had this exact problem with Danganronpa 2, which I love the first one, and I really like the Virtue's Last Reward, the sort of like sister series, I would say, to this. But I could not, I bashed my head against the second Danganronpa for like several hours, and it just like was not hooking me. And I'm sure it picked up eventually. It's just like, you have to really be in the right headspace for one of these games.
Sure.
And in a month where there's so much other stuff to play, it's a little tough.
There's a lot of lore, and not only that, there's 16 characters, right? And obviously that gets whittled down. But you do, before you can start the game, like, you need to know like what this world is about, what the stakes are, what the rules of this world are. You have to know like what the different environments that you're in are, because those are going to be like clues later on. And then you also have to get to know these 16 characters to an extent where you can like know how to suspect them later on.
If you're wrong at the end,
then everyone dies and it's a game over.
Question. Yeah, but like, Can you just like reload a save?
Yeah. You just redo the class trial. There's not permadeath in this visual novel. That would be pretty wild. You'd be like fucking Moby Dick. It's like turn page 51 if you shot the harpoon good. Turn page 53 if you missed. Turn 53, throw your book away. You lost. Yeah. You lost Moby Dick.
Throw it away.
A question. Is this like Nier Automata where you have to like keep playing to see all the endings? Because that feels like a thing that I've heard about. A lot of visual novels.
Yeah, that's a valid question. Let's keep talking about Nier Automata.
Yeah, no. You like how I got that in?
That's definitely part of the Virtua's Last Reward series. It's
the best part about VLR, but it's yeah. It's also it's Zero Escape. Virtua's Last Reward is the
Zero Escape,
second
right,
game.
Yeah. It's the second
No, no, no. That has never been a facet in Danganronpa so far. May in this one, but okay. I'm pretty sure it won't be.
What does the title mean?
Danganronpa means, I think, truth bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Because you shoot truth, you shoot evidence. It's very literal. Uh-huh. Like you get evidence, which takes the form of bullets, which you actually shoot into statements. There's a lot of new stuff you can do in the class trials in this one, and the most like buck wild one is the basic thing is like somebody will say something, and if you have a piece of evidence that contradicts it, you shoot it into that statement, and it you know counters their argument. But if you hold the button, it turns that statement into a lie, and so you can perjure yourself to like try and if the case just reaches a standstill and you know that everybody is on the wrong person but you don't have evidence to support it, you can lie. And so you have to be thinking sort of like on two Ooh. Levels whenever you get like really really stuck in a class trial of like, okay, well, can I lie to like perjure myself but try and move the case forward or try to incriminate the real culprit? It's really smart. They've done a lot of stuff to the class trials to make it more interesting this time around.
Cool.
Any other honorable mentions?
I mean, I feel like I've done all of them, but there's a new Picross game on Switch that's extremely good if you like Picross.
Well, let me ask you about Picross real quick, because I have dipped my toe into the waters of Picross, and the impression I get is that it sort of like caps out pretty quickly in terms of like variables.
So the big one that they add
2D.
The big one so Picross 3D, if you didn't play it on 3DS, is like, in my opinion, a must own game on 3DS. It is like a brilliant puzzle game where it is Picross, but it takes place on you know with these 3D objects where you're chiseling away blocks, and there's different rule sets, and it's very like it's very cerebral and very rewarding. In this one, they have mega lines. So the basic premise is like there's a number, and that tells you how many blocks are filled in a line. And you have
no
to,
way you can explain Picross in language. It's just not.
In this one, it has mega lines, which basically tells you there are shapes across two lines that are connected bricks, right? So it could be like a tetromino T across two lines, and it'll tell you four, and so you know it's going to be, you know, maybe three on top or one on bottom, and so you have to factor those in on top of the normal rules, and it's really difficult and really requires some good brain thinking to figure out.
I got one. Heat Signature is the new game from Tom Francis, who did the very excellent Gunpoint. And this one is, imagine Hotline Miami, except you can sort of pause time whenever it makes sense for you and sort of plan what you're going to do, and also sometimes teleport weapons and objects from the level into your hands. So mechanically, that's sort of the idea. But the setting is space. You're sort of a mercenary bounty hunter type, and you have a crew of people that you can sort of switch between as you go. Each one has a different thing that they're trying to accomplish in this world while you reach towards an overarching goal. The basic thing is you pick up a mission. Sometimes it's assassinate someone. Sometimes it's steal a ship or whatever, and you go out and you're tiny little space pod and basically have to fly into the ship to hijack it, and then it turns into that sort of top-down Hotline Miami perspective. And there's just a lot of really cool ways it handles stuff like if you get shot, for example, in while you're on one of these missions, you get knocked unconscious and get thrown into space. Basically, they take you to the airlock and flush you into space, and you have to grab your body by remote controlling your pod to fly into your body and pick it up. But that character then permanently has less time the next time they get shot to get picked up. They have less oxygen reserves.
That's true. That is scientifically accurate.
Yeah, so that's how it works in science. Mm, but yeah. It's just a lot of really cool stuff. Like in the moment, you can decide, like, well, actually, I'm going to kill everybody and take this ship for myself and go sell it.
And so it's not like a very specific objective, like Hotline, where it's like, well, kill everyone. And that's what you're doing. You're killing everyone. Sometimes,
no, you do have that very specific objective. Like it's always like assassinate this person. Sometimes it is steal a whole ship. Sometimes it's steal a certain thing off of the ship. Sometimes you're racing against time before like alerts start getting set off, and you can sort of stealthily make your way through a little bit. But it's a really interesting. Tom Francis does a lot of really smart stuff with like minimal design choices and subverts them in really interesting ways. But it's a really cool game. And
I feel like Gunpoint
Signature.
I feel like Gunpoint, which was his other game, was well received, but also like very intimidating in terms of the mechanics. Am I thinking of the right game?
No, Gunpoint was pretty straightforward.
Where you like program switches and stuff.
Yeah, you do that, but it's very fun.
I was too dumb for that game.
Intuitive, if you're a sort of thinking person.
Yeah, I'm not. I want
to mention a game I actually haven't played yet, but I think is really cool, and I'm very excited to play it. I think I'm going to pick up a gaming laptop and maybe take it on the go with me, because it seems like a good game for that, is Divinity Original Sin 2. I played the original one. It is like a, you know, top-down, you know, CRPG.
It's like a Baldur's Gate.
I think CRPG is the name of the genre.
Baldur's Gate.
The original Divinity Original Sin was so cool because there's so much stuff you could do with like actual physical interactions in the world. Yeah. So you could like pick up a barrel full of oil and throw it down to create a pool of oil and then cast a fire spell on it to like blow it up. But it's taking place in this like turn-based CRPG sort of format, and it was really smart. What I love is in speed runs of this game, the original sin was to the fastest way to do things was to take a chest and fill it up with like a billion things to make it weigh like a megaton, and then use like magic or hacking maybe to lift up that chest and like drop it on enemies to instantly kill them because it's so heavy that it does. It's like that shit like that is in the game. And
have you seen the teleportation videos?
No,
where people are getting like I don't know how Original Sin 2 works, so pardon me if this is all technically wrong, but people are ramping up their teleportation powers, and then instead of fighting bosses, teleporting like the big bosses to the other big bosses in the game, and then just having them kill each other.
That's fucking great.
That's great.
That's crazy.
So like that stuff is really cool, and from everything I've heard, like Original Sin 2 is like an RPG masterpiece, so I'm excited to dig into it. Yeah. What I wanted to mention is that it also has what's called Game Master Mode, where other people can, I think 4 people can hop into the world, create their characters, hop into like this online environment that is run by another player who's playing as the Game Master, and they have a suite of tools to run people through like proper like pen and paper RPG D&D style
crazy
adventures. So they can like create these text prompts and have you roll dice to like get through them, and then do battles where they control the enemies, and they can use like fog of war to lock things out, and they can create items on the fly that they can drop into people's inventories. And there are modules that will be released to like help lead you through stuff. One of them is the starting one that comes with the game is actually Lost Mines of Phandelver, which Juice and I have played a couple times now. It's the starting starter's handbook adventure that comes with 5th edition of D&D. It seems really, really, really cool, and I would love to like get a group of folks together to try to play it sometime.
Did they license that?
Yeah.
That seems a good streaming thing.
Like, yeah, I think it could be really fun.
I think, yeah, we could definitely do something like that.
I have one other thing I want to mention. I think this technically counts, but the SNES Classic Mini.
Oh, yeah.
It is such a great thing, and I'm so glad that it feels like Nintendo is still having its way. There's a scarcity that they're getting video of people waiting on lines that can fill up morning shows and build up hype for Christmas, but it seems like people who wanted a copy on launch day, for the most part, were able to get it.
Yeah.
Plant and I went to the same place and didn't realize it.
Yeah, because they had so many copies.
Right, like 50 of them, yeah.
Yeah, but it is so wonderful, and it is, I have hooked it up to, we have a projector in our bedroom, and having it hooked up to something like that where the cords aren't really an issue because it's just right next to the bed.
Yeah.
It's such like a nice little like treat. And that feels like such a nice place for it to be. I can picture it in the dorms, especially, and it just being such a perfect little thing. And when you think about how expensive these games are to own legally, what a joy it is that there is a somewhat affordable option for people to own things.
What
does
it work out to, like, $5 a game at this point?
I think there's 22 games and it's $80, so less than that. I mean, like, a copy of Final Fantasy 3 or 6, but 3 in America would cost you probably about $60 these days.
Super
so,
Mario RPG. Yeah. I mean,
what have you been playing mostly? I've been digging into Secret of Mana just because it's one of my favorite games basically of all time.
I've been picking at Super Metroid just because I don't know if I ever finished it as a kid. I remember playing most of it.
It's a ridiculous lineup. It's like, you keep looking, like, it is baffling. And it's been really cool to, like, my daughter's 3 and she can't really, like, grok a lot of the gameplay mechanics, but she, like, being able to show her this stuff from my childhood and being able to turn on... the one that I was most excited to see for some reason was Super Castlevania 4. That was it's the first SNES game that we got, and I can still remember, like, what the moment when I held the chain whip button and could move the direction around, and the whip just flailed all over the place. And I can remember thinking as a kid, like, you could never do this on the NES. Never. Look at that whip flipping around. It's amazing.
Mode 7 and up in that game. There's some amazing
the
shit in that
game. The whole Mode 7 level, I think it's the underground level, is, like, so fucking great.
The thing I kind of found interesting, I was able to pick one up as well. I was actually not going to get one, and then stupid Amazon parked their stupid treasure truck, like, a block from me, and I was like, oh. So I picked one up.
What a curse.
And I know, it's the worst.
Anecdotally, it was not as hard to get. Well, I showed up at Target at 7:55 and just rolled up on one.
I guess, and you sort of mentioned it, but it kind of made me think the other day how interesting it is when we think of, like, nostalgic games, and we have this picture of, like, pixelated games. And the reason, you know, pixel 2D games are a big deal is because a lot of people that are making games now grew up with those types of games. And it's kind of interesting when you think of, like, there was a part of me when I was growing up, like, when the N64 came out, I was like, okay, 2D games are basically done. We're never going to see them anymore. And now there's this, like, new wave of nostalgia, which will impact the current generation. So Justin's child will grow up with 2D games, and that will be part of their nostalgia as well.
Yeah.
And so it kind of lives on. And I thought
it's like 70s culture. Like, we had 70s culture as teenagers, and now there's, like, certain 70s fashions that are bouncing again.
Yeah,
as we, like, have kids. The thing that I cannot wait for is there is a culture, and, like, just a shout out to these people, Tumblr artists who were raised on the Sega Dreamcast, and I love that you can start to see a wave of nostalgia for that window of video games, and I love it. I don't know if there's going to be so much warmth for Nintendo 64, like, PlayStation 1 era. Because are those games rough? I think they're kind of what NES, the, you know, having the NES Mini to the SNES Mini was.
No, I think early 3D games just age really, really poorly.
Yeah,
is the problem. Like,
well, I think
obviously Mario 64 is great, but, like, most of those are pretty brutal.
To that point, holy shit, Star Fox 1 is unplayable, y'all. Yeah. that frame rate, I did not realize how fucking bad that was. Like, I remember loving that game as a kid, and playing it now is like, whoa. I honestly thought the SNES Classic was, like, I thought mine was broken because it's literally, like, 4 frames a second. It's super bad.
By the way, Sega, if you're listening, Mini Dreamcast Classic.
Oh my god, I would devour
can
it.
Can you just do it? Please.
And it has to come with a VMU, you know, because if I can't carry around my little KO.
we gotta move.
Let's get
games.
Cranking. Justin is doing Destiny, so why don't we save that for last? So we
I can
take
go
more
first.
Time and let's move through ours a little quicker.
So I'm bringing a game called, I'm gonna screw this up, Metroid Samus Returns, I think is the name of the game. I hesitate only because the game that it's based on, which was Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, but essentially it's a remake of Metroid 2. And remake's probably not even fair because it's really, like, a total...
I have no idea why they called it. I have no idea
why
this is
not a... It's a total conversion.
Yeah.
You know when, it's like every aspect of the game has been completely redone. The map is completely different. The art is fully 3D. It's a 2.5D game, but, like, it's all 3D graphics. and just every single aspect. The only thing that they kept the same was the plot, which is Samus needs to go to the home of the Metroids and murder every fucking one of them. And you do that. And it's just, I think what's amazing about it, and I felt the same way about Metroid Zero Mission, which was the remake of the original Metroid game that came out on GBA, I think? GBA? Yeah, GBA.
Yeah, right.
Basically took all of these things that you remember about these classic games and love about these classic games, and then added modern gameplay design concepts to them without...
And also a ton... Zero Mission had a ton of new stuff.
Yeah, and a ton of new stuff.
It added basically another chapter to the end of the game that was kind of buck wild.
But it doesn't feel like a departure or a rewriting. It feels like additive on like what the core idea was. It kind of just like paints a new coat on this like nostalgic memory that you have with like gameplay that is not like a total chore to get through. And Metroid, the new Metroid, which is on 3DS, probably the last 3DS game I will ever play if I had to guess, which is kind of a bummer, but also bringing this shit to Switch now, I hope. It adds stuff like countering attacks, which I think has only been in one Metroid game so far, and that was Other M. But in the 2D Metroid games, you can basically, like, the fact that you can counter an attack in a 2D Metroid game means, like, the, like, clumsy eight-directional aiming shit is gone, where if you have the proper timing, you basically counter an enemy as they're attacking, and you basically annihilate them the second you, after you counter them, and it feels, like, really fluid and cool. There's some amazing boss fights in this game, apart from, like, so you fight, like, shitload, I think there's, like, 40 Metroid boss battles
those
in total.
Those have been pretty... lame for me so far,
because it's like
the same. The Metroid fights are just like kind of the same thing over and over again, it feels like, except like there's slight changes to their patterns. I don't really,
I mean, they get
part of
pretty
it.
Fucking complex. I don't know how far you are. They get pretty fucking complex towards the end. I kind of liked that you would like meet one and it'd be kind of a tough fight, and then they'd like change the environment around a little to make it a little bit harder, and then the second that you felt like, okay, I've really like I've mastered this fight, like I crushed these Metroids, the Metroids evolve, and then you're fighting like a completely new one with different patterns and different styles and stuff like that. So I like that, but there's also some other boss fight stuff that I really thought was just like some of the best boss fights in Metroid history are in this game. There's one in particular that I don't want to spoil, but it's really spectacular, and it's just like, oh God, I couldn't put it down. Like I reviewed it, and generally, you know, for review games, you kind of have to play it very quickly and it's a drag. But here, like, it matched my pace of like how often I wanted to play it, which was all the fucking time until I finished it. It's really excellent. If you're a completionist, there's like some really smart completionist things in there that like don't make you look on a game fact to find every single collectible. You can like actually find it all in the game. And it's just fucking great, man. If you love Metroid, especially classic Metroid, but really any fucking Metroid game, it's one of the best they've ever made. And I feel like it's kind of be forgotten by nature of it being towards the end of the 3DS life cycle. But shit, dog, it's so good.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Griff, go ahead.
I have enjoyed it. I got to like the second part of the, or the third part of the world.
So early. It's huge. It's a lot bigger than you think.
I know. It's very, very big. My main complaint, I don't know how to get past this, and it's kind of what made me stop playing it a little bit. Also, the fact that this is a very competitive month. I don't think it feels very good. And I think my biggest complaint there is just like, I don't like having to use the analog stick to move around in 3DS games, because like I don't think it feels great. Like if there's ever an option to use the D-pad, especially in a 2D platformer game like this, like I will always opt for that. And like that alone, also like I don't know, it feels very it feels very fast. Like the way that Samus moves, like she falls very quickly and you know, turns her momentum very, very quickly, while in like another 2D Metroid game, like it's a little bit floatier. And so that combined with having to use the stick, like it doesn't feel that great to me to play it. And I get that you have to use the stick because there is 360-degree aiming this time around, which is, which is, you know, kind of a cool thing, but Yeah, I kind of just wish I could move around using the D-pad just because that.
Yeah,
that,
I'm struggling I don't in the same way. That was exactly what I was gonna hit on. It's just this is not a knock against the game proper. I just hope it like they bring it to Switch or something because I really don't enjoy, I really don't enjoy the feel of the game, and I think it is just centered on the disc. I don't like moving around the environment with the stick. It just feels weird. And I also don't like the having to stop to aim with the trigger there to give me that like complete control. It just doesn't, I don't know, that part just isn't clicking from a control perspective.
I think it's just 2D games that bothers me. Like a 3D game, like the Super Mario 3D Land game, the stick is fine. And like a top-down 3D game like Animal Crossing New Leaf, like I don't mind using the stick to run around a 3D space. It's just having to like go around a 2D environment, like pressing down on the circle pad to like duck to get, you know, a different angle on your shots. Like, I don't know. I just don't think it feels very good.
That's fair. It also is, this is not really a complaint about the game, but it is also weirdly infuriating to start a Metroid game and not have the things to not be able to instantly turn into a morph ball and then
balls. No, that's all of them. That's every Metroid game.
I'm not saying it's all of them. I'm just saying like it's very irritating to have to back out of a tunnel to shoot the thing when it's like, I know you know how to do bombs. You've run this so many times. Please tell me you still remember how to do this.
She sold all her equipment between games.
That was quick. That's nice.
That's all fair, but I think it's a great game.
There's got to be another 3DS game coming. What about all the... Atlas is re-releasing like a bunch of really great Nintendo DS RPGs, including Radiant Historia, which nobody played and was a fucking masterpiece.
Put that shit on Switch, dogs. I'm sorry. I'm charging enough devices right
also
now.
Also, the Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga, like one of the first great, is coming out. They're doing a remaster of that.
I would buy on Switch in a heartbeat.
Yeah, like, but I mean, I got the new 3DS XL, which I really, really enjoy. Or I guess the new 2DS XL, which I think is really fantastic. So I'm actually eager to play more stuff on it.
I do love that Mario and Luigi early games are great.
Yeah.
Next, let's go with
Cuphead. Yeah. Let's talk about Cuphead. Oh man, released in a whirlwind of controversy comes Cuphead, a very perfectly okay boss battle collection that is a throwback to 1930s cartoons and 1990s running gun shooters for mostly the Sega Genesis, like Treasure Games, Gunstar Heroes comes to mind.
Metal Slug.
Sure. Kind of.
Boss battles.
Wise. Yeah, it's mostly boss battles. I think that they realized that releasing a collection of boss battles in the year 2017 is a little unusual. So there are a handful of platforming stages throughout the game that I don't quite know why they're there, because it doesn't feel like that's where their hearts were. But the boss battles, wow, are they good. For people who like a little bit of difficulty, who enjoy shmups, who enjoy bullet hells, who enjoy learning boss patterns and then exploiting them, this is the game for you. It is you play as a Cuphead. You can play with
a Cuphead. His name is Cuphead.
I'm sorry.
There's a race of Cupheads.
There could be.
His dad could be named Cuphead.
Yeah, he could be Cuphead Jr. And then Mugman is your co-op person. And you just fill enemies with little projectiles. And it's mostly static screens. And they use different patterns and you master them. I mean, it's really, really simple on the top level to talk about. The joy of it for me, having played through it, is I think it to do these games well, you have two things that you have to nail. One is, where can I be on screen? A lot of good shmups have, you have your spaceship. When I say this, I'm talking about shoot 'em ups, where you're flying around and just waves of bullets are coming at you. You have your ship, but then you have a dot on the ship, and that is like the point that can't, you know, be touched by a bullet. The rest of your ship is fine. So yeah, like you it has to communicate those things. And I think Cuphead had a huge challenge in itself, in that you're a large character, and also it's this beautiful 1930s animation making it look good and natural and not just be the cliche glowing red areas on a boss is very, very tricky. And they communicate it very, very well, barring some issues at the very end. The other thing is also just nailing the feel. You're talking about your movement. I played it with an Xbox Elite controller with a D-pad, and it's a shame these things are so expensive, because I think that is really the best way to play it. It feels
so
much better.
I mean, the normal Xbox controller has a D-pad on
it. It does, and I played it with that too, and it's...
Here we go.
It's fine.
There you go.
It's fine.
Fucking elitist.
Oh,
I mean,
come
literally
on.
We can't
do a type 5 on, I can't use my hockey puck on my DS on Samus, and then be like, oh, no. We can't have that.
We can't spend $150 for a controller.
No, I agree. I'm not saying people should do it. I'm just saying it's a shame that the basic Xbox controller doesn't have a good D-pad. That's all I'm saying.
Remember they tried to fix the 360 one by making one that turned to make it good?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That? I forgot about that.
The other thing about the controls is the default controls on this game are horrible. Like, I cannot believe it shipped with these controls. They make no sense. The game is all about speed and timing and being able to do multiple things at once. And the decision on their end was to put all of the main powers on the face buttons. So your thumb just breaks and contorts. The only way I could figure out playing it at first was using my thumb and then essentially making an okay symbol with my thumb and pointer finger and using the pointer finger to press the other face buttons that weren't like, I think, X and B.
Wait, why didn't you just change it to triggers?
No, I did. I eventually remapped. But I assumed there was a reason that they wanted me to use this finger torture. And I was wrong.
I think the reason they did it, and I don't think this is a smart reason, is because they wanted to make the controls as basic as possible. And a lot of people that are like casual people don't really grok the like trigger thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. So by just using face buttons, it made it a little bit easier, but that also doesn't explain the locking being on a trigger. So never mind.
Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense. One other thing that I was impressed by, and I was curious about this when I saw it in previews, is these cartoons do not have the best history. Racist caricatures were kind of like a bread and butter of this period.
Yep, right.
And for the most part, they are able to maintain that style and in some cases reference the worst, like the really nasty aspects of it, without actually depicting those terrible things.
What is an example of that where they reference?
I'm not gonna go it there. Like
I honestly
don't know how to like talk about it without
sounding awful. I found I was looking for it too, and I think anyone that like knows that era of Song of the South and stuff like that is certainly like very aware of it. And yeah. I think they lean. It seems. Pretty, it seems like they handled it with like a lot of kid gloves for the most part.
Yeah.
Which is for the best, really. Yeah. Like that shit should not be in this game,
right?
Yeah. I think it was good. I don't think it's nearly as hard as the hype cycle like made it out to be. I think it's way more what?
Here he
pro
goes.
Gamer.
Get good.
I think it is. On top of just being able to tell like what's hurting you and what you can hurt, it really, really cues you into what an attack is going to be. Like if you think about the punch out thing where, this character is twisting left and right two times, that means he's about to deliver this attack.
Right.
It forecasts its attacks very, 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 very clearly. So if you are patient and learn how to do that, for the most part, I feel like once you know how to beat a boss, it's only a few more rounds until you do it. It doesn't have that issue, again, except for the final bosses, where I know how to beat this, but the game is so punishing that even though I know the path to victory, I can't achieve it. And that's a thing that I don't enjoy about kind of classic running gunners, is it becomes more of a thing of just arbitrary skill. the end in luck, where you don't have like a limited number of lives to have to worry about. You can the second you are frustrated, you can retry and it reloads the battle in, I don't know, a second, a half a second. So it's so much, it's all of the things that are good about that period of video games with so much of the fat cut away.
Weirdly, though, speaking of loading, I played on the Xbox One and it has been
slow.
A grip since I played something on the Xbox One. I mainly play on the PS4 Pro and I think I've been a little bit spoiled because the loading into the world and out of the world, like loading up missions and stuff, feels pretty onerous.
Do you have that same thing when you restart? Like when you retry inside of a mission?
No, that loads right away. But like going back into the world or starting a new level, like it takes a little bit.
Yeah.
Can we play this together? Because it's got co-op and that's how I want to play it because it looks really fun, but I haven't
tried
it. Yeah,
I want to try it. Co-op looks like it could destroy friendships because the difference is you share a pool of life and you, when you revive, to bring somebody back, you have to parry them, but really that's just kind of tempting you to get
yourself
out of
in
your
danger.
Safe spot. I'm very curious about it.
Yeah, I've seen, so I played a little bit of co-op in the office and I played, and they do two interesting things. One, you're right, like the parrying system, which I think is really awesome, the like reviving another player before their ghost flies off the screen is like really cool.
Yeah.
It also increases the health of all of the enemies in the game. Bosses and little guys and everyone. So I actually think it is a lot harder to play in co-op, but it's super fun. Like the like strategy and finally making it to the end. Like there is a celebratory element to this game that should absolutely be like applauded. And I think they did a really good job of making it like a great couch co-op game.
Yeah. I do
want to
say,
just can't say enough about the aesthetics too. A lot of times with games that have a specific look, you get a little bit inured to it after a while. It kind of fades into the background. But, man, it's just so considered and deliberate and, like, unlike anything, I think, in video games that, like, it was really delightful. It's one of the few games, like, I got my daughter into the room. Like, you have to see this, and then you have to watch Daddy curse.
And it's holistic with them in that it nails the – when you're in a boss fight, it looks like Steamboat Willie, essentially. But when you're in that overworld, it has that look of almost like a Disneyland map. Combined with the first world you are in, the music is just a riff on Disneyland Times Square. It is really...
Main Street?
Thank you, Main Street. That would be a very different park. but yeah, every little detail is so good at that. I really wish the final boss battles were good because it is weird that this game that is all about just fantastic boss battles ends with woof. The penultimate boss is you have to fight between 3 and 9 bosses and then do this impossible parrying exercise and basically store up lives because there's not really a great way to do it. And then the final boss, I swear, has a bug in it that deals automatic damage if you don't essentially perform a dodge the way that the game wants you to. So it was a huge bummer, and I hope they patch the ending heavily. I hope they take the criticism because it's such a drag for it to be so fair.
Yeah.
And then
I'm surprised to
what should be exciting, and just I really just had to brute force it.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you had trouble with it given like specifically given your controller and how great that is.
that's what I hit the just win mode on my controller
I do want to say one more thing before we close it out. Not the friendliest of colorblind friendly games in the world, and if you are colorblind, just specifically the issue is they use two colors a lot, purple and pink. And pink you can parry, and purple you can't. And the problem here is that they both have red in them, and it is really, really difficult to tell them apart at sometimes. Certain art, it's doable, I can tell, but certain art is like a real struggle, and for a game that's all about like very quick movement. good fucking luck.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind.
I want to talk about mine real quick because we don't have a ton of time and I want to get to Destiny. But my game this week, this month, is Golf Story for the Nintendo Switch. This is a golf RPG from Sidebar Games, sort of in the style of the really good Camelot Mario sports RPGs, Mario specifically Mario Tennis and Mario Golf. For Game Boy Color and Game Boy Advance, which are, in my mind, sort of the pinnacle of this. I feel like Russ and I have talked specifically a lot about games like this, probably on Besties, and how modern Mario sports games have kind of lost a lot of the magic that made those games so great.
I don't get it. Like, those were tens. Like people
love
gave
them.
Perfect scores to those
Mario
games.
Golf
and
Advanced
then like,
Tour is a fucking wonderful, wonderful, wonderful game. And I'm glad to say the Golf Story maintains a lot of what makes those games really great. It is a golf RPG where you play sort of this fledgling golfer who is trying to make their way in this circuit, and they are in this world that is entirely made up basically of 8 golf courses with different themes. And what's really neat about the game is that it just drops you into a course and then gives you free rein to go around exploring that course. And in exploring it, you can find lots of sort of hidden objectives and bonuses that you can just sort of go around and find. You can level up and get money that you can use to purchase a few new goods. And by leveling up, you can increase certain stats. It does an interesting thing with leveling where if you boost your power, which basically increases how far you can hit the ball, especially from drives, it decreases your more technical stats. So you have to be
that was a thing in Mario Golf as well, though.
That
was a mechanic.
I guess so. I don't really remember. But it makes sense, right? If you boost your drive so you can drive it, 250 yards, then your control is going to be a little bit off and your spin is going to be a little bit off. And so you constantly you can't just like rush that. You have to be constantly sort of maintaining your other stats. The side quests in this game, I think this part's probably going to be a little bit divisive, in that you, in like following the story, you are going to do a ton of side quests. And I would liken these to, objectives in like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4, where you're just going around the world and you're not necessarily going around doing, missions where you're doing stunt combos, you're doing weird shit. Like for instance in Golf Story, maybe that entails getting a lawnmower and mowing the grass or hunting down moles that have taken over the course and hitting balls into their sort of field. What's really neat is that you don't have to like load up one of these missions to start golfing. You don't have to start a course to start golfing. There is a button that you press and you just drop your ball on the ground and now you can shoot. And so like anytime you are anywhere, you can golf. So maybe you see like an island off in the distance and you think that there's something on that island. You can just drop your ball, hit it over there and then see what's up. Maybe there's a switch that you have to like hit. There's also a neat skill that you can unlock where you drop the ball or you throw the ball up in the air and then you can hit it right away as it's falling, which feels really, really sick every time. In general, like it feels really good. It is one of those 3-hit golf games where you hit... you aim your shot and then you hit it once to start the meter, then you hit it twice to choose your power, then you hit it a third time to choose like how well you control the ball. And so that is the basic loop of the game. You will go around following this story, which entails you to like do different favors for people on the course or explore parts of the course to find things, and then you will usually end sort of your run on each of these 8 courses by actually playing that course maybe against other people or in just sort of an open game to see how good a score you can get. And the writing is surprisingly pretty funny, and
it's kind of like
you likened it to Undertale. I guess that's a weird comparison for me because like there's lots of funny games out there. It's also sort of in line with like the Mario RPGs
a little bit.
And it's very like irreverent and humorous. But yeah, like this is my jam. Like I really liked my favorite part of the Mario Golf games was going around the world and finding different stuff and like finding little secrets and finding ways to get better. I wish there was my two big complaints is I wish there was more gear that you could like spend money on. Like whenever you find a new pro shop, there's usually only a couple things that you can buy, and usually one of them is like kind of situational, helping you solve a puzzle in the world that you're in. For instance, the first pro shop you unlock, you can buy a disc, and then all of a sudden you can use that to play disc golf, which is like a whole nother thing that is
pretty fun also. And then you can buy like a club or two. I wish there was like a store with a ton of stuff so you could be like saving up your money to buy things. Usually it's just like, do you have enough money to buy the one or two things that is available at this store? But the other thing is that there is there are what's the word I'm looking for? Like slopes and like different
angles
whenever you are putting or hitting shots, and there's a little UI indicator telling you like which way the ground is sloping and how like severe a slope it is. I wish that that was more represented in how it is in games like Everybody's Golf or Hot Shots Golf or the Mario Golf games, where it shows you like on the ground like, okay, this is going a little bit, you know, down downhill towards you, so you got to be hitting a little bit harder. Using that one UI thing makes putting kind of tough, and it makes like measuring your putt pretty difficult. I've botched a lot of putts just because like that one indicator isn't really enough of a visual language to tell you like to help you aim your putts correctly. And so that's kind of frustrating. But otherwise, I think it feels like a really great golf game, and the golf is really fun. There's not like a ton of actual proper like playing through a course that you will do, which is I find myself at times like just wishing like, okay, I wish that the story now required me to play a course, because I would like to golf. But on the inverse of that, I loved Everybody's Golf on PS4, but that game is just all golf for the most part, and it gets, I stopped playing it because that gets tiresome. So I wish the balance was like a little bit better, but I just really enjoy exploring these worlds and doing all the different little side quests that they have through them. I think it's also a perfect game for Switch or mobile. I would still be playing Everybody's Golf if it was on Vita for sure. So yeah, I think it's a really great little game.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I thought the writing was great. Tonally, it's a lot of fun. I like doing the side stuff. I did find myself, and this is kind of a weird thing, but I found myself kind of wishing that they bit more of what like Mario Golf did on GBA. Like you talked about the putting, which I 100% agree with, but like a lot of stuff, like the way they handle shot previews is a little weird. The way they handle putting spin on your ball is weird. There's like no, like the whole like backspin mechanic is like, it just feels like odd. So like it does feel like they kind of made this with more of a focus on the RPG aspects than they did the like really minutia of like golf, which I think makes golf games really good. I'll give you like a really simple example of in Mario Golf on GBA, and I think on Game Boy Color as well, when you are putting and you get really close to the cup, it actually does like this cool zoom in on the cup to show you like how close you are to like getting it in. And like that's something that I kind of missed here. Yeah, there's just like a lot of like if you're looking, as Griffin said, if you're looking for like a real golf game, Hot Shots is excellent and is really like that. And I kind of wish they were like married a little bit closer and this was a stronger golf game, but I really enjoy going through it. The other one minor complaint I have is that the side quests really are not side quests insofar as you need to do them to progress the story. There's like
some of them are. Some of them are like you have to go, you know, help the groundskeeper in order to like fix up the course in order to play the tournament.
But there was an instance where like I needed a shovel, and for the life of me could not find where I could like figure out where I could get a shovel.
I got caught up on that also.
Yeah, and you're like totally stuck, and I've done everything else in the map and I'm running around like a blind person. So there are a couple instances where I think they struggle with clarity in terms of what they want you to do, but for the most part it's fine and a lot of fun.
As somebody who doesn't know anything about golf, I found myself this is going to be embarrassing and stupid. I found myself really frustrated by the fact that I would set up my marker for where I wanted the shot to go, and then I would get the shot perfect, and then it would go way past where I wanted it to go.
Yeah, the ball travels. The ball travels pretty far, and you got to like count it. You eventually you learn to counter for that and like hit it.
A lot of times,
it's
defaulted me to a golf rod that is inappropriate for the thing that they want me to do, which forces me to kind of change that on the fly, which is probably not weird for somebody who like knows about golf games, but for me, I found it
a little tricky. Coming again right off everybody's golf, like I kind of had a better understanding of that stuff. Like to Justin's point, like if you hit the ball, it is going to go way past where you think it's going to go because the ball is going to roll. And so the way you counter that is by maybe choosing a different, a different golf rod. And like I always put backspin on pretty much every shot that I do, just so the ball doesn't go forever and ever and ever. So yeah, there is some institutional knowledge that is very, very helpful in that regard. Let's get to the big show. Let's just do it.
It's a big show. So a very good game released this month is called Destiny. Is the second one actually? So Destiny, Destiny Returns, is it?
Destiny, yeah. Destiny Samus Returns.
Destiny Samus Returns. It's called Destiny 2. Okay, so the first Destiny was a game that was built to be a sort of online, persistent, first-person shooter where you could endlessly collect loot with your friends and have unique stories connected to all your weapons. But it was basically fundamentally a broken game. That was a lot of the systems underneath the shooting, even though the shooting was excellent, a lot of the systems underneath the shooting that would compel you to continue to play it were bad in a way that I think is probably the worst they could be, in that they were designed to sort of addict and hook and keep you grinding on things without giving much fun or new things in return. And for the people that was effective on, it was very effective. And I think it was almost kind of a cruel game at its inception, though.
You're talking about the vanilla.
I'm talking about vanilla release. Original Destiny. I'm walking us in a little bit.
Okay.
And then as Destiny grew that put a lot of people off. And the people who that was not designed to attract bounced hard and got a really bad taste in their mouth about Destiny. Over the years, Destiny got various expansions that made it a much more, I would say, humane experience, a lot more pleasant, a lot more, it felt a lot easier to justify your time spent in Destiny because there was a lot of stuff to do, and it was all really enjoyable. So enter Destiny 2, where they have sort of defaulted to that, where you are a guardian who, at the very beginning of the game, loses your light, which is sort of code for superpowers in this case. Because it's been stolen by a mean guy named Gaul, and your objective in the story is to take down Gaul, get your light back, for all the guardians, and rescue the Traveler, which is a weird
superpower
alien ball. I'm gonna try to do like components really fast. Story wise, it is a huge improvement over Destiny, which was a barely sort of tattered together collection of scraps of fragments of story. This is a much more coherent story. It's much more especially towards the end, it ramps up in ways that are evocative of some of the best moments in Halo, where it takes what you know and puts it into a very grand sort of operatic setting that feels very cool to do. So story is a huge improvement there. The things that are sort of hovering around the story are a lot more pleasant. There are adventures that are like mini quests that you can do that are cool and handcrafted, though don't evolve over time. They're lost sectors, which are basically like miniature dungeons that you blow through and kill a boss and get some loot. There are public events, which there were in the original Destiny, but they are sort of bigger battles that theoretically require multiple people to pile on and participate in. But these are more humane in that you used to need an app to tell you when these things were going to pop off. Now you get a map with a timer and everything, so you know exactly when it's going to happen. And they're also a lot more rewarding than they used to be.
And a lot more fun. Like, that is the activity that I have spent most of my Destiny 2 time doing, just because there's no gate on it, and it's, like, instantaneous, and it's usually, like, pretty rewarding. I fucking adore what they've done with public events.
So Destiny is, I would say, the key differentiator. If I were to boil it down to one thing, It is a much more rewarding game than Destiny 1 ever was. And that works in a lot of contexts. It's rewarding in the sense that the things that you do inherently in the game, I think, are more fun than they were in Destiny. And they're much more pleasant. So it's rewarding in that sense. It's rewarding in the sense that you get your loot much more quickly, it feels like. The drop rates on the sort of most sought after items, the exotic items, are a lot faster. There's a ton of also legendary, which is one step below that. There's a ton of those items to collect, but you get them at a really steady clip. There are also sort of built-in grinds that have been chipped away. You used to have to level up your weapons by using them repeatedly and collect these really crappy little resources on the planets to level them up. That is gone. That part of the grind is gone. So in almost every sense, it's more rewarding. I think that is the thing that might hamper it for some people, in that after playing it a ton, and I do mean like a lot, I don't know exactly how much time, but a lot in the past few weeks, I feel pretty much like I've done everything I want to do. And that is not necessarily a complaint for me, who has other things they want to play. And I would say it is by the design of Destiny. But I do hear a lot of people who want to just keep playing Destiny, that they don't feel a lot of reason to keep grinding away. And the important thing to note here is, I think that is largely the result of artificial progression being carved away from the game. Things like having to gather resources and upgrade your weapons and things like that.
And random rolls on weapons and armor, which was the thing in Destiny 1 where a gun would drop and be like, oh, these perks suck, so this gun isn't good, so I'm going to keep trying to get the good one. In Destiny 2, all the guns are static. They have the same perks across the board. And so you get one and you've got it. There's no need to like keep going back to try to get a better version of the one you've got.
Yeah, but there, it feels like there's a ton of stuff to do. It's really like, if you're looking at it from the perspective of I'm paying $60 for a game, I think it gives like a ridiculous amount of value. If you're looking at it as this is the new game that I want to be playing all the time until there's new content for Destiny, I think that you might be a little bit frustrated by the fact that you will get to a point where you're like, well, I feel like my time here is done. I think that that's healthy personally. But I know that that's not everybody's cup of tea. I one quick thing before we move on, I want to do like 2 minutes on the raid. So if you're unfamiliar, the sort of big final piece of end game content that you do in Destiny games are raids. And these are six people, large, long, I don't want to say even quests, they're basically huge dungeons that you have to take on with six people. They require a ton of collaboration. They require a lot of very high power. This is the thing that you're getting your power higher for, so you can do well in these raids. The new raid, Leviathan, for this game, the first one released for it, I think is... It is interesting in that it is much more mechanical than other raids have been. Pretty much every encounter in the raid requires really understanding the mechanics of the fight. There aren't a lot of times where just shooting your way out is an option. You mechanically have to understand what's happening. And I think that that's good in some regards. One, it makes them, I think, more interesting to do. It requires more collaboration. It inspires a lot of weird vernacular that everyone has to sort of agree on as you're going into it, because people
bottom
call,
dogs, bottom dogs.
Yeah. The last fight in the game has an area where people are teleported to, and some people remain behind. We've heard that referred to everything from like home and away teams, Shadow Realm, and
Throne Room.
On the Giant Bomb stream, they call it Spooky Slide. So like there's a lot of different nomenclature that has to be arrived on. And I think that that's really neat, the way that that inspires, really forces collaboration. You used to be able to carry people through the raids. If a few people knew what they were doing, the rest of the people could kind of hang back and watch and learn. And I think that that's interesting that that's not really the case anymore. Flip side of that, there was a stated goal with this game that it would be something where like you would not, if you were a more casual player, you'd be able to see everything that Destiny has to offer. And I do think that by making them so mechanical, the unintended side effect is I think it would be very daunting to try to approach this as someone who did not understand the mechanics, because I think that because they are so mechanical, because that's explaining and understanding those mechanics can slow things down so much, I've already felt a big resistance from people wanting to teach new people how to do the things in the raid.
It's not just the mechanics. It is the fact that there is, in all of the encounters, zero margin for error. No joke. The raid is four encounters. There's three sort of challenge rooms that are every week. They arrive in a random order and the final boss. And in all of them, if one person, doesn't kill their dog at the right time, if one person screws up the rotation in the baths, or if one person shoots the wrong target, or fucks up something in the gauntlet, or the wrong one person like doesn't call out their symbol in the callous fight, in every single fight, one person can lose the run for everybody, and there is, again, no margin for error.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if we're going to be literal, I don't fully agree. I've been on runs
there's
in every
very,
encounter.
There's very, very little margin for
very
error.
Very little, yes.
Which makes it daunting, because if you're a new player, you don't want to feel like, oh, thanks for taking me through this, everybody. I'm really excited to try the raid. And the very first time, everybody kills their dog and you don't, and they lose a really good run because of you, and you know it's because of you.
Yeah.
That is going to make people say, like, okay, well, I'm not going to do this. We should mention guide. Go ahead.
Oh, so that's also exacerbated by the fact that the raid has revive tokens. So in each encounter, every player has one token that they can use to revive somebody. So if one player is maybe new, not sure what they're doing, and they're dying a lot, that becomes like that becomes very obvious and very detrimental very quickly. Just one more note on that before we move on to Guided Games. The raid is rated at supposedly 260 to 280 is like the range of it, which is like your power level. If you start the raid at 260, you'll be fine. By the end of it, if you are in that range of 260 to 280, by the end of the raid, you'll be getting destroyed. You really do need, especially if you're the only person who's a lower level, I think you could probably get by. But if most of your team is in that range, you are just not going to have the juice to get it done. And I think that's kind of a misleading thing that could be fixed.
I want to hit on that too really quick before we get to Guided Games, because I really, really like this game. But the artificial capping and artificial strengthening by way of your power ranking is infuriating. And the idea that, one, you essentially can't play raids until you devote a tremendous amount of time to the game, and then even once you do get there, that you are lesser than your peers simply by virtue of you not committing more time to the game, I find it like kind of disgusting. And I find that it feels to me, and this is very, very much my cynical mind, that it is so much of Activision's success right now in the success of MMOs is measured on metrics. How many hours can we keep somebody involved? Because at a certain point, they're more likely to spend money. And by locking away the thing that everybody talks about, it forces people into the metrics that they want as a company. And I think that's like upsetting, because on one hand, people are like, wow, we got all this free content. And it's like, no, you didn't. You played the amount that they need to meet a certain metric that they're going to sell ads against, that they think that they can get you to spend money against, and they are putting content back, not because the player isn't ready for it, but because it feels like a business decision. And I think that is just infuriating.
I would disagree with that.
Let me address. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, okay.
Let me address. Go I don't it, think... First of all, there's a lot of things to unpack. First of all, technically, if you are 280 or 281, you have pretty much the same advantage as someone that is light level 300. So Justin's right, like you really shouldn't be under 280 to finish the raid, but I don't think you need to be max light level to finish the raid. So there's that. Talking about the monetary decisions and making a game a certain length to encourage people to spend money, people will disagree with me on this, but I think the Destiny monetization systems in Destiny 2 right now are pretty fucking tame,
yeah,
considering where they could be. There are some gameplay impacting things
that's
that you could
bullshit.
Buy with,
it's mods like for your weapons which you can get from right. a billion other places right. for
effectively and, there aren't
yeah I disagree with it being a business decision. I think that this is just the model of these games and literally any MMO where there yeah. There has to be a final like check on your
something
abilities,
for you to work
something
towards.
For you to work towards, because my complaint is that there's not enough of that stuff in Destiny 2, because I am one of those players who has played it several hours a day every day since it came out, and only now I'm starting to fall off a little bit because I have two characters at the highest light or power level that you can possibly get to right now, and one who's like one armor piece away from also being that. As of last Friday, I have collected all the exotic weapons in the game. Like I am one of those people who has hit the point where there is nothing left for me to do, and because there's some of those things have been removed, which I did not mind when I was leveling up, things like random rolls on weapons, my biggest complaint with progression is armor, in that there's not that many like there's no interesting perks or modifiers on your armor, and so there's not a real reason to, once you hit max light, to like go and try to like collect a whole set or go get the raid has unique pieces of armor and weapons, right? And all the armor looks really cool, but there's not really a reason to go out and get that stuff. And in Destiny 1, that was different. There would be pieces of armor that would give you perks that would help you out in certain parts of the raid. Like if you had the boots from Oryx, then you would move faster in the final boss fight against Oryx, for example. There isn't stuff like that in Destiny 2. And so I don't really feel this need to like go play anymore, because this is a game about like playing the stuff that is there that is going to like help you out or get you new stuff or get you better stuff. And I've hit the ceiling, and there wasn't really so much, there was a ceiling in Destiny 1, but if you wanted to talk about it in the literal sense, it was like, you know, getting the best roll on all these weapons and getting the, you know, the armor that's going to have the stat bonuses that you need to like max out. And because all that stuff is gone in Destiny 2, like I got nothing left. There's also like a lot of stuff that got cut made Destiny 1 a lot better that I have no idea why it's not in this game. For instance, you have a vault where you can store all your items, and it's not sort of segmented. There's not like a weapon vault and an armor vault to like help you, you know, sort your items a lot better. It's just one big pile of shit that sucks to go through. And then there's things where like there are activities where once they stop being rewarding for you, no matter what, you're just going to stop doing them. And yeah. One of those things that becomes irrelevant pretty much instantly is strikes, which was my favorite thing in Destiny 1. It's the thing I spent my most time doing, is these like little, usually like 20 to 30 minute missions that would go through, and they would usually be pretty rewarding. And there's not really much of a reason to do it once you hit a certain breakpoint. In Destiny 1, there were strike playlists where by the end of the experience of Destiny 1, after all the updates and expansions had come out, they would have like a, you know, a scoring metric to them. So where if you did really well, you'd get better loot, and there were playlists. So if you kept playing strikes in the playlist, you'd keep getting better and better gear because there was like a buff for like chaining your strike clears together. That's gone here. And so there's like, I loved strikes in Destiny 1. I just don't play them anymore because it's like,
yeah,
it's kind of pointless.
It does feel like, you know, between console generations when like the new Madden comes out, I realize this is kind of a time based thing, but it does feel like there's a lot of functionality that happened late in the generation of Destiny that I loved. Strike, like specific rewards is another example. Like there's a bunch that they added in like Rise of Iron that I thought was just great. And the impression I get, private matches is also not in Destiny 2 yet. I get the impression that there was just a lot of triage happening towards the end of Destiny 2. And I earnestly do believe a lot of this stuff will make it back into the game.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's a bummer to like have that reversion on certain aspects. And you're right, like I don't run strikes apart from the Nightfall, even though they're a lot of fun, because it isn't quite where it should be. So I think the game, even by December, will have one of the expansions will be out by then in theory. I think will be pretty drastically different in the way that Destiny 1 Vanilla was pretty drastically different by December. But yeah, I think that, I think all of these are 100% valid complaints. And if they don't come through and fix a lot of this stuff, it's a real bummer and it detracts. But I also, pointing to what Justin said earlier, like I played hundreds of hours of Destiny 1. And there is something really kind of nice and freeing of the feeling that I'm like, I don't need to play tons of Crucible to get this perfect roll on a hacksaw pulse rifle that I really want, because I'm like happy with where my gear is and I can go off and play other games and do other stuff.
Sure.
But if, again, if you're looking for a game that you're going to play day in, day out, week in, week out, it does not necessarily have that long tail built into Destiny right now.
But I'm like, I also love having a game where I am excited for the future of it. And I am not, there is no game right now that I am as bought in as I am in Destiny 2. Like, I've played it tons and tons and tons of hours and, you know, have worked to get all my characters up to max light. And now I am like ready for the next thing to come out. And I know that is like a complaint among the most hardcore players of Destiny 2. Like, there's nothing for me to do now. But like Justin said earlier, like I played it every day for several hours a day and probably put a couple hundred hours into it. That's good. That's good for me. And there's a shit ton of games, you know, that have come out and are about to come out. And, I bounced off the first Destiny because it went too far in the other direction, like way too far in the other direction. And I'm like, I have adored the time that I've spent. Also, like, they have already added stuff in to, make the game, to added in some hooks to bring you back, like the faction rally that came out this week. The Trials of the Nine, I had a lot of fun with once I found a group that was like really, really good at it. And I hope that that's the direction they go, instead of like keeping you hooked by making you go out and, you know, get the perfect rolls on weapons or get, you know, some dumb shard that you need to upgrade your weapons. Like, keep giving me more event based stuff. And I have every, that Bungie has earned my trust in this department that they will continue to do stuff like this to get me going. Stuff like the Black Spindle, which there's nothing like that in Destiny 2 right now, but there was a quest in the first Destiny that you just had to like find. It was like a secret exotic weapon that required like this incredibly difficult thing you had to do to get it. And like, once they start rolling stuff like that out into the game, like there's no shortage of ways that they can just keep adding on to this like foundation that is, it is impossible to argue is a weaker foundation than Destiny 1 was.
I want to circle back real quick to something that Plant said. Like, I hear the, you had some pretty strong language about the, like, the, I guess, morality of
designing
some of the design. Is that enough to sort of put you off?
100%. I find a lot of the culture around it not ideal. Like, the thing that I would recommend to people is, like, everybody here who's talking keeps mentioning that you're playing, like, hours of this game a day, which makes us, I think, especially as, like, adults with, like, responsibilities, fortunate, I guess. I think that, like, a lot of people cease to have that opportunity at a certain point. And what I find frustrating about the culture around Destiny is what you'll find across the internet is, here's how to max your character. Don't spend any of these items until you get to this point in the game. And what we haven't talked about at all is the game. Like, the first 25 hours, there's a game there that is, like, a pretty good game.
It's a fucking great game.
That you're encouraged largely in the community to completely gas through. Nobody wants to actually play it with you. There aren't really good incentives for playing it with you. Not using your items, for example, until a certain point actually kind of ruins the balance of that game to make it less enjoyable. And I think that's what's frustrating is, again, by gating these things, I get it. I totally get what you mean by you have to have something to work towards. Otherwise, you know, then what? What motivates people to participate in the grind? But then kind of my like flip side of that is, you know, I'm still playing Spelunky all the time because it's a good game. And sometimes I feel like with this game, what we're talking about is I really just want a mindless grind that I can do that hits just enough of a balance so I can like talk with my friends on a daily basis while I play video games. Which if that's a thing, that's great. But if that's a thing, then I wish this game made it so that I could play with my friends. Like, I have played a lot of Destiny. I think I have been able to play with my peers twice. Because even though I am level 263 or 264, I'm like not good enough. And that's wild to me that I have invested so much time in a game, had to like skip some of the best parts because like the culture around it is whatever it is.
And sure. Yeah, that's true.
I think what they're actually suffering from, though, is residual behavior from Destiny 1.
Yeah.
Like, Destiny 1 taught you, like, churn. Destiny 1 taught you, don't waste time on the story because it's bad, right? And, like, find ways to min-max your progression time because that's literally all there is to do. I mean, it's just that, right? It didn't account for like some of these things are fun. And I think what you're maybe running into, Plant, is that some of those changes have been made, but the player base is still not. It is wild to follow the sort of like hardcore fan reaction to this game because it has been this arc of one, how do I get max everything as quick as possible? You know, building on that, like still lingering psychology from the first Destiny, and then a week afterwards there's nothing to do in Destiny, I've done everything, and it's like did that,
and
like,
you can break
that to yourself,
you can break out of that too. Like I said I've hit essentially max light on two of my characters, and because there's no random rolls and there's no like I've gotten all the exotics, so there's not much, there's nothing really for me to continue to pursue. When I hop on at night, which again is a lot more of a infrequent occurrence, just because I there's not a whole lot of stuff for me to do. I've been having a lot of fun just like hopping into a fire team with my friends who are, you know, playing through public events, trying to get stuff or running other stuff with those folks. I guess my complaint is because like strikes are now irrelevant, and there's not a lot of mid level activities Plant and I could do together. There's only really the raid at this point for Plant, which
Nightfalls too, right?
And then Nightfalls, I'm not a huge PvP player, but I wish there was more stuff where now that I'm max light, I could do to like help out my friends, because right now it's just like grinding public events, trying to get exotics. There's like weird breakpoints. There's weird in the typical MMO parlance is hell levels, where it's just like, well, if you can't get from 265 to 280, like that takes a while, and there's not a lot of great options for you to do that. I've broken out of that cycle for the most point by virtue of the fact that I beat it. I overcame the cycle and hit the end of it. I hit the max on everything, and now I'm like actually enjoying playing the game without that carrot in front of me. And that carrot requires you to do some very, very specific stuff and essentially ignore everything else. I enjoy playing that stuff now, but it did require me to play a couple hundred hours of only going after that carrot and only playing the specific stuff that benefits me.
Sure. I also, I think the way to think about it,
107,
I don't think it's
by the way, Ditto.
Jesus.
I don't think, good work. I don't think that it's a,
you're at 60, right? Let's get good.
I don't think it's a design problem necessarily. Maybe it's a presentation problem in terms of like guiding people to the right spots. I think the issue is really, it's a humanity problem. It's a gamer culture problem, as Plant sort of alluded to. And gamer culture is not just, you know, I'm going to play 1200 hours and mainline my way through this game to get to the end game content. It's also Chris Plant, who can only play, let's say, 1 hour every couple days. And the problem is you're trying to design a game, and this is not a knock on Bungie, I'm just saying how difficult it is. You're trying to design a game that appeals to both of those groups. And for me, I certainly probably lean towards the more hardcore of the group, but I'm not the extreme. So the fact that I, in the back of my head, are like I play with a bunch of guys that are like much more extreme hardcore than I am, in the back of my head, I'm like, well, I need to sort of stay in their general realm so I can still experience this endgame stuff. But then again, that leaves someone like Plant, who's more casual,
yeah,
out to, ideally, yeah, in an ideal world, you would find other casual players to experience this content with at your own pace. That being said, I think specifically for the raid, which has always been like a very intense, super hard thing, I like, if you had six pretty casual players playing the raid, I think no one would get through it.
Now, we should mention, because we addressed it earlier, but we never really dove into it, is the guided games feature, which Bungie included, yeah, where if, yeah, you are a player like Plant, like, you could ostensibly hop into guided games and then find a group that is willing to take you through the game, take, yeah, you through either the Nightfall or the raid. And so that is in there. It doesn't make
has
the raid any less.
Has anybody here tried that? Like,
I have not, no.
I haven't tried it. I've heard it takes about 45 minutes, or at least it did, mm-hmm, take about 45 minutes to get into a group. Which makes sense, considering you can only do guided games with five other people, which is to say, like, there can only be one noob, as it were, sure, in this group. So it, I mean, it's 45
but
minutes,
and gonna,
I also
that's
hear...
gonna get better. Like, a lot of the stuff we're talking about, yeah, also is a symptom
wait,
of the
wait.
Fact...
I want to hear what else Russ has heard.
I was gonna also say, it's kind of a bummer, as far as I understand it, even though I haven't tried it myself, there's no, like, I'm gonna queue up for this and then do my own shit. You basically just sit and stare at a menu.
That's a bummer. Yeah. A lot, yeah, of this is symptomatic of the fact that this game is new and everybody is, you know, really excited to keep playing and get the highest stuff. That first week was wild because the raid came out week two. And so there was this, like, there was this really high tension race of, like, okay, well, don't turn in your milestones. Don't start this quest. Don't turn in these things until you hit this cap, or else you're not going to be able to get to 280 in week two and be ready for the raid. Like, that race is still, even though, you know, a lot of this stuff is out now, it's still in effect. And I think it's going to get better as sort of the experience goes on and there's more stuff to do and there's not this, like, pressure to, like, max out right now.
Beyond so that, stupid. Yeah. I think it's beyond stupid that they released the raid a week after release. It should be, hell, put it out a month after release. Like, if it came out now, I think everyone would be like, they'll take a little break and then they'll be real excited because there's new content and it stretches things out and it lets people that are more casual into the right light level.
Yeah.
And it's not a race. Like, it de-emphasizes the insanity that happens at launch during a Destiny game.
I played
game.
The game in an unhealthy way that I did not necessarily enjoy as much as I could have if I had taken my right. time and explored more stuff and done more different kinds of activities instead of just, like, one or two very, very specific activities required to get you there. And while that's
nice,
that was yeah. its most intense form that first week. I think that is still in effect, and I think it's gonna get better.
It's
just a bummer because the raid's the best shit in the game. Like, raiding in D1 and
right.
the raid in Destiny 2, it's still, even though there are some problems with Destiny 2's raid, we didn't talk about, like, some of the bugs that make specifically that final boss fight, like, really fucking frustrating. I still really, really enjoy the raids, and it's a bummer that only, like, the top, you know, 2% of players ever actually, like, play and complete it.
I think actually 10 is the
yeah, it's probably up to
10
now. It does increase over time, obviously. It's just funny that, like, everyone in the world that plays Destiny gets to experience the stress and unhappiness that comes from having to review a game in 2 days. That's like I reviewed Destiny with Submit. And the fact that I was, like, grinding to get to the raid because I had to because of the review, but so was everyone else because they felt like they needed to play the raid at launch.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of funny, a little sneak peek into what it's like to race through a game even yeah. when you don't necessarily want to.
Let's wrap up because I gotta head out here in a few minutes. But for my money, like, even though it has problems, like, Destiny 2 is, like, still some of my favorite time playing games this year, so I think it's definitely the winner this,
yeah, yeah.
this month.
I think Destiny 2 for sure.
Yeah. Last month the game that won was my game Echo Lone Echo. But I thought right. that game was really, really cool and had a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And if you have an Oculus, you should go get it. I think Destiny 2 is my jam.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And this is the end of the quarter, right?
October, November, December is the final quarter. Yeah. So this is
oh wait. No, so Lone Echo. Did Lone Echo win the last?
Yeah, it won the last one.
This is for September. We're talking September right now. So this is the last game of third quarter.
Right. July, August, September is the
right,
third.
Right, right,
right.
Got so, it. Okay. Yeah. So do we need to pick a winner of the quarter
no,
in this
we have,
stupid exercise?
We have, no, Destiny is the winner of the quarter because it beat the reigning champ. So currently right. we have, if memory serves, we have The Legend of Zelda,
Zelda,
PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, and Destiny 2.
What a fucking year, y'all.
Oh.
What an insane.
Yeah, pretty brutal.
Yeah, what's and, October looking like, everybody?
Yeah,
there's not really anything coming out in October, so we're fine.
Yeah, new Mario, the Shadow of War,
Assassin's Creed.
I just love that Mario and Zelda are going to face off in a Game of the Year thing.
Wild.
And they both might lose to PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Yeah,
there's
we'll
a
see.
Chance.
Juice, take us out. Take us to do the thing you usually do.
Well, take us to orbit.
Folks, let me take you to orbit. Thank you so much for listening to the Besties. You can find more about all of these games and, believe it or not, other games at polygon.com. We would love it if you would rate and review our show on iTunes. If you enjoy it, that is a great way of sharing it. And maybe like tweet about it or something, just to let people know that we're here toiling in obscurity, just hoping for you to spread the good word. We would very much appreciate that. That is going to do it for us for this week. So for my co-hosts, my name is Justin McElroy, and thank you for listening to the Besties. We'll be back with you again next month, because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games? Ah.
Besties!